Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hi everyone, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now my guest on the podcast this week is the four-time Bathurst winner, the king of Pukekohe, the all-round nice guy and patient. Well, he was patient with me because we asked lots of questions, Greg Murphy. Now, part two of the pod, we cover lots and lots more stuff. We talk about the Spider-Man Bathurst Kmart program. We talk about the 2004 Gold Coast press conference where he and Marcus Ambrose asked more questions of one another than any media probably did that day. Winning the 24-hour Bathurst race in Peterborough 05 Monaro. The National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions, and there's some corkers relating to Bathurst 05 and that crash with Marcus Ambrose. And Murph also tackles the Motor Focus Top 10 shootout. Enough of me. Let's get into some chat with Murph. I talked to him recently over a Zoom call. He was at home in New Zealand. So here we go. Buckle up. Time to start what I think is a really great part two of Greg Murphy on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken.
There is so much to talk about. And I'm trying to avoid the obvious topics that you're probably sick of talking about. And it's hard to do a podcast with so many of our guests because you've talked about so many of these things so many times over. But Kmart, Lap of the Gods, all that stuff, that's been talked about a lot. The one I want to hone in on from that era, and I've got to admit, and I'll put my hand up here, and I've mentioned it on the pod before, in 04 I was the Kmart racing PR guy. So if you look in the background of some of the shots, there's an idiot with a white Holden Motorsport shirt on, that's me. But I have very fond memories of that late part of 04. And, of course, it was the second Bathurst win, which is kind of a bit overlooked by the Lap of the Gods thing from the year before, but 04 was its own beast where that wasn't quite a win that the car had the pace that 03 had, but it did at the right time of the day. Do you remember when we wheeled out the Spider-Man car and it got a lot of publicity, which was the point of it for Kmart because they had a toy sale that was starting soon after. So that was the thing. But remember that it was for just Bathurst. But then the car and you and Rick won Bathurst. So everyone thought, it's a good luck omen. Let's leave it on. And you kept winning because you went to the Gold Coast and won again. And I think Rick won a race at Tassie and then blew an engine and we decided, right, let's peel them off because the luck's over. But Spider-Man helped you win a couple of races, my friend, no doubt.
Yeah. I loved all that kind of stuff and, the changing it up. And it didn't, maybe it was the start of things too because, it wasn't big back then that people did different liveries and shifted them around the place. And, it was like when you rolled it out at the beginning of the year, that's pretty much how it stayed. And I think even from memory, I think the boys were like, oh, God, we can change the livery. Oh, what a pain in the ass that is. I mean, it was all a bit funny. It's become the norm these days for liveries to change race by race. But, it was cool having, memories like that and attachments to those little stories. They were, Kmart were a great sponsor. They were bloody good back in the days and we were fortunate to have them. Obviously they finished up at the end of 2004. Things changed there and it was all over. But they certainly got their lion's share of coverage and recognition through the period that we were lucky enough to have them at TWR, Kelly Racing, whatever it was called through that period. It went through a few different name changes.
It was a feisty little period there too because the competition between Kmart and Stone Brothers was pretty solid there, particularly late in 04. And that delivered us the best ever press conference on the Gold Coast where you took over interviewing Marcus and it turned into this rumble that there was background to it though that I think a lot of people forget from the day before when he accused Rick of brake testing him or holding him up in the race, because Rick had had an incident on the first lap of the Saturday race, I think it with Russell Ingall at the the chicane, got a penalty, came back out just in front of Marcus leading. I think you were running second, and he couldn't get past Rick the whole way, and he brake tested him on the run over the line at the end of the race, and it turned into, there's some video there of the aftermath, and you're pointing and shouting, and Marcus is spitting a few out, and he's giving one to Rick, and I'm in the background, and I'm getting phone calls from Murray Lomax at Channel 10 to make sure that Rick's interviewed and not pull him away, and it was really festering up, and it started that day, but the press conference was actually the following day. What do you remember about all that, and did you go in with a plan to stick a couple into Marcus while you were there, or did it just come up as it started?
No. Actually, you've got me, because I would have said that it was actually the same day. So it was actually the next day, was it?
It was on the Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. So, and it was actually Rick was behind Marcus.
That's right. He followed him the whole way.
He followed him.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
Which was even more strange, because all he did was sit there behind him and run the same pace and for however many laps it was. But, you know, Marcus had a bit of a gap. I couldn't really do much about it. It was just the speed that we were doing. And Rick wasn't impeding me. From memory, there was nothing like get out of the way or whatever. But at the end of the race, you know, we've crossed the start-finish line. Marcus crossed the start-finish line. And, he had just not appreciated the fact that there was another car there, and he gave it a big boot on the old brake pedal crossing the start finish line, and it was a brake test because Rick had to take avoiding action, but I had backed off the throttle but flew straight past them both up against the wall, going, what the is going on here? Anyway, we get back to the pit, and after the race, and it's like, what's going on? And actually, Marcus came down and wanted to give Rick a bit of an earful about the whole thing. And I was sort of, you know, usually a very calm, controlled kind of character, but I just was like, what are you, you know, I was there, and he sort of started to attack Rick for really doing nothing. And so I decided to get in on the act and throw a few barbs, and it was like, you know, accused him of brake testing, whatever. And so, as I say, I thought it was actually the same day, the press conference, but it was the next day. Did I win the next day? Did I?
You did.
I won on Sunday. Okay. And so we're in the press conference, and someone brings up about the fact about, you know, what happened the day before and what was that about. Oh, you know, and he answered whatever his answer was, which, you know, I didn't take.
I think you laughed at him, actually.
I think I laughed and then I said something, and it all went from there. But it was a very humorous and quite interesting press conference, because it certainly wasn't what he expected it was going to be. And I actually absolutely had not had a plan to go in there to bring up what happened on Saturday or bring up about that whole situation. But being that he had answered it in the way he answered it, I decided, well, that isn't actually how I saw it, and that's not what happened. So I decided to wade on in, as I did, with my red bands on.
So you didn't jump on the brakes after the start-finish line, and that's why I went flying past you,
Greg,
Marcus?
This is my question, mate.
Yeah, I'm just asking you a question as well.
As much as you like.
I'm asking you a question. You didn't jump on the brakes.
I'm not going to answer your question, mate.
Well, don't answer it then. I'm just asking, and if you don't want to answer, that's your problem.
Well, what do you want to talk, mate?
Well, because I flew past you as well, and I was off the throttle, so you tried to slow down for some reason. Haven't got an answer for that.
Any further comment at this stage, Marcus?
Mate, look, Greg, you're allowed to slow down after the finish of a race, I assume.
Oh, right.
You know, like, these guys, we're fighting for a championship. It's getting pretty messy. It's very disappointing that they want to play that way.
What's that? Play what way? Is Rick not allowed to follow you? Is that not the idea of car racing? I mean, that's the issue. Why'd you jump on the brakes?
I slowed down after the race, so I don't dispute that. I totally refute the allegation that I brake tested Rick. I had words to Rick after the race because I was upset about his sportsmanship during the race. I refute the claims of what I said, and it's simple as that, mate. Simple. I've got nothing else to say. It's an absolute joke the way that Greg carries on. It's an absolute joke. It's an absolute joke the way that Mark Scaife goes in the first corner, and he has no intention to turn in the corner. You know, like, I'm fighting for a championship here. I'm trying to do the right thing, and I've got guys that are getting him away.
Mate, they're not just going to pull over for you and let you win the championship. That's not car racing. You know, you might have won it last year, but everyone's still got to do a job out there, and we've got sponsors on the car. We're allowed to race you. We're not just going to pull over and let you win the thing, all right? I'm sorry, but that's not the way it works. I mean, and Mark doesn't have to pull over and let you past either.
Any other questions?
Get over it.
I don't think that any journalists had any questions left because you asked them all. He looked genuinely quite shell-shocked that this was even happening, and he was clearly under a lot of pressure and didn't look. I'd be really interested to talk to him now that time's passed about how he was dealing with it all there. But when you're the hunted and you're the number one in the category, and I remember his line was, "I'm trying to win a championship and these guys are getting in my way."
That's exactly the line.
Car racing. That's the aim of the game. Yeah. It's going to move over and let you through. Clearly, he was starting to show the signs of being the one that the arrows were being fired at, which you are when you're number one. And it just festered and it fell apart on that day. But he got fined $10,000 for careless driving and failing to exercise reasonable care after.
Is that right? See, I've forgotten that.
I just looked it up while we were talking because I was trying to remember what the scenario was. And lucky enough, we keep all of this data here at our office, so you never know what we might dig out.
Yeah, it was interesting because he really wasn't under any pressure, and Rick wasn't trying to do anything. And Rick back then, when we were talking, so 2004, how old would he have been? 16 years. I mean, he wasn't smart enough to think to be doing anything that would have been helping me or underhand. You know, he would have just been moseying around, driving along, doing his thing. And I hope he watches this and hears that I said he wasn't smart enough. So, you know, that was the irony and the sort of the funny side of it was he was just sitting there, really, you know, wishing that he probably could get unlap himself, but wasn't going to do anything silly. So, yeah, funny times. And, yeah, I suppose that was a bit of the catalyst moving forward for Marcus and my sort of ongoing feud that came to a head at Bathurst 12 months later.
There's a question about that in our Couch Racer Questions segment of the podcast where, with thanks to the National Motor Racing Museum at Mount Panorama, fans have sent in some questions, and there is an interesting Bathurst 05 question that we'll launch a little bit later. By that stage, and we're jumping around all over the place, which is what we do on this podcast anyway, but you were leaving. You decided to depart Kmart Racing to go to PWR for 05. Rob Crawford was leaving and then didn't leave. When did you make the call to leave, and is it the biggest regret? I know you can only make decisions based on the available info at the time. You can never predict what's going to happen with anything in racing or life, as this year probably proves to everybody. When did you make the call to leave, and how did that all unfold, and did you regret looking back on what that team that came up became versus the team that you ended up going with? And it was a bit of a struggle to get you back to a race and championship challenging situation after that.
Well, I never did I? After that decision to leave Kmart and leave, you know, the Kelly Racing / you know, what was it? Walkinshaw / sort of arrangement there. When did it come about? I'm trying to think. I'm not sure how early, late in 2004 discussion started, but I got contacted by Mark Rowworth, who was the commercial guy at PWR. And, you know, it was floated and I, you know, about me doing that. And obviously Jason Bright was leaving. And the performance there of, you know, those guys was pretty strong. I mean, they had the same cars effectively as what I had. So that was a big tick, you know. I was like, I'm going to go and east another team, but drive a car that's very similar, if not pretty much exactly the same. And they were a customer car from TWR. And you know, their offerings were good. The sponsor, obviously, super cheap, was good. I think at the time I may have already been aware that maybe Kmart weren't continuing as well. I'm not sure. But it sort of stacked up, you know, and Phil Keed was there as well. And that was something that was really important to me, that he was going to be there. That's something that did change, which threw a spanner in the works big time, because, you know, I was really confident heading there that he was going to be part of it. And I was, you know, I was sort of, wasn't led to believe. It was, you know, that was one of my questions, like, you know, is Phil staying? Because that was such an integral part of making the decision. And I was told, yes, he's staying, definitely. And unfortunately, I got let down by that, which was, you know, I don't know why, what happened there. I can't remember what he decided to do. Maybe it was because he found out I was going to be there. I don't know. But he left.
With Bridie, though. So he went to FBR with him. It's probably the bit that would think about the puzzle there. Yeah.
Yeah, so they had a good relationship, but I was told that he wasn't going to be leaving, he was going to be staying. So that was a big part of the decision-making process of going there. And you know, they were doing a good job, they had big plans. And again, it's one of those things, you're given information. And hey, it's not like the first year was terrible. We had some great results, amazing, really cool results. It was fantastic. We fell into a real big hole for a long while when the decision was made to go away from the supply of engines from TWR and go to Perkins Engineering supplied power plants. And that, you know, seemed like it should be quite a straightforward exercise, but, you know, it turned things upside down. Big time, and we lost pretty much all our momentum. We gathered some of it back, but we never really recovered from that fully. And then 2006, the team didn't start very well, and just got worse all the way through. And then subsequently, at the end of 2006, so you know, Keyes was very good enough to let me leave, pull out of my contract, and head off to Tasman.
So you had another year to go on that deal there.
Yep.
Yeah. It's just the nature of life. If it's not working, then if everyone can be big boys about it, then move on.
And he was you know, very professional and straightforward enough about it. And I'm not really sure what why it all went upside down there. It just didn't, you know, things just didn't happen in 2006 the way they were intended, and we really, 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 really struggled for whatever reasons. Our race cars at the end of the day.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Apologies for jumping around on the timeline, but... a couple of other little things I wanted to touch on. Earlier this year, before the world went weird and you did get to drive some race cars, you got reunited with the Bathurst 24-hour winning Monaro, the Nations Cup 7-litre 427 car, the red car that you won with Brock and Todd Kelly and Jason Bright in. It's owned by a private collector now. It's had a few owners since it was a GRM race car from back in the day. Tell me about the memory, because that was only, what, a month after you'd done the Lap of the Gods, won the Bathurst 1000, were challenging for the Supercars Championship, and then you win the Bathurst 24-hour. So it's a pretty big month or two that you had going late in that year. But tell me about the car, tell me about driving it again, and tell me about the whole program there to go and do that race and win it.
Yeah, that was mega. Obviously, the guys had won it in the yellow car 12 months earlier, the 24-hour race, and then, you know, word started to get around they're going to run another one in 2003, and Nathan Pretty was involved in that, and then Brock was going to drive the other car, and then the whole process just all came together. Holden wanted to you know, fill the second car for the 24-hour with blokes, and we were all contracted and obviously ready and willing. So Bridie, myself, Todd, and obviously PB stuck in the 05, and it was awesome. It was such a fun fun time and fun race, and obviously ended very, very weirdly by being given the green light to go and race the last 7 minutes of the 24-hour race. And I just happened to be aboard the 05 battling it with GT. And it was wild. It was just totally wild. But the car was, sort of reuniting with it back in February. You forget how agricultural they are as a car. I mean, they were built really well, but just, they've still got the dash in them, the original dash, the rules, I think, around the regulations and stuff. You had to have, the dash needed to be still in the car and bits and pieces. And they just, it was a funny thing getting back in it and driving it. It was really just like a road car hotted up pretty much. But it was awesome to get the chance to strap back in and be reunited and bring back a flood of memories about driving the car.
For those that don't remember that radio conversation between Gary Rogers and the Monaro drivers, let's just pause for a second and have a listen to the audio from 2003.
Very, very interesting chat going on. The Gary Rogers Motorsport Radio, David Addison. We don't know what it all means, but some link to the 7 minutes.
7 minutes. Look, please, when this happens, can you understand the work and energy and effort that all your workers have put into this? I expect a fair go for everybody, but it is vital for both of you to finish.
Well, there you are. Clear directions from Gary Rogers.
At 7 minutes, something is going to happen. And remember, the team, said Gary Rogers, you've got to finish.
Murphy with 0.3 of a second over Garth Tander.
Please give each other a fair go. Thank you.
Please give each other a fair go.
Sorry, Gary, say that again. 7 minutes now, so race for it, but please give each other a fair go. And as I said, respect the work that these people put into it.
Okay, so it's the other way from what I predicted. They've got 7 minutes to go until the end of the race. Now it's the game on. The way he's done this does surprise me, I've got to say.
This is dangerous, isn't it?
It is. It's dangerous, but I tell you what, it's fun, folks. Get into it. Look at this.
So tell me, when that radio call comes through, you can hear it in your voice, absolutely perplexed, wondering, is he taking the piss or is this legit?
Yep. It was like, sorry, please, can you repeat that? I just want to make sure I'm clear that you want us to race for the last. I can only imagine. I did hear afterwards the reaction from Bev and Peter in the pit lane. I think was a bit shock, that was going to happen. It was a shock enough for me in the car. You know, here we are with Brock driving this thing, 05, big red bloody 427 Monaro. Can you imagine if I stuff this up? Can you imagine if I freaking get this wrong? And GT slides up the inside somewhere. It was the most crazy last couple of laps of any race I've ever been involved in. I mean, it was like Apocalypse Now around the racetrack, because there was cars crashing, there was yellow flags, it was wild, freaking wild. And to be honest, there's a decent amount of blokes that you'd be quite happy to have in a battle like that with you. But, I was pretty happy that GT was there. He knew what needed to be done. As much as he wanted to win a second 24-hour, he also knew what was at stake, as did I. So it was a pretty pretty wild couple of final laps, but very memorable.
Well, you are still the reigning carryover Bathurst 24-hour champion. You are yet to be defeated. You are still the holder of the crown.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I also managed to steal the trophy as well, so I've got that at home.
Yeah, what?
Well, one of the trophies. I think we all got given them, but I don't know if it was part of the deal or not, but I've got it.
Oh, I hope no one's listening who can take that. But right now, no one in Australia can get on a plane to come over there and take it back from you, so I think you're all right for a little while.
I think I'm all right. I think I'm okay.
That probably brings a really good question too. We love talking about the memorabilia. We love talking about the bits and pieces. We talk to other drivers about what suits they've kept, their helmets. Some of them are hoarders. Some of them don't give a crap and get rid of it all. I know that you're not a hoarder, but you do keep most stuff. A few years ago, you had a bit of a charity auction that you donated a lot of money to charity in New Zealand, and you sold some of your stuff. And I'm very lucky that here in the office, I've got your 2004 Bathurst winning race suit. It's been really nicely framed up, and is a very, given the connection that I had to that race win, that's a very special and valued part of the collection here at Sleuth HQ. But what have you kept? What are your most prized possessions, and what are some of the things that are perhaps the oddities from your career that you've kept tucked away?
Yeah, it was a really weird one. Just sort of going back a step there when you're talking about the auction that I had. I mean, you know, I had pretty much everything. I used to give a lot of, you know, team gear away, sign it, you know, for charities, that kind of stuff. And I've, over the years, people that have supported me, I've given helmets to, you know, I've also auctioned a few off, sold a few for charity as well. So, you know, it's one of those things, you know, when you start adding up the gear and, you know, race suits and a lot of the contracts, all the deals that I had done, you know, you got to keep one of the suits at the end of the season, and generally, you know, you used to have two suits for the year that you'd wear, a couple of helmets, that kind of stuff. But you do start to collect it, and it starts to take up a lot of space. And it's one of those things. It's not, I never, you know, was going to have a room somewhere where I was going to have it all hanging up or that kind of. I mean, you can imagine the cost. You know what the cost is like trying to frame a suit, and then hang those up. And it's like, well, then they're just sitting in boxes. Then they're just rotting. Now, what's going to happen? Who's really going to care about it down the line? And I just got to the point. It was like, I got so much stuff. It's all in boxes. You know, it's just a waste. And as you said. Yeah, some guys treat it like it's, you know, like trophies, and they treat it like it's the, you know, it's a really important part of their lives, and they need to have it or whatever. And that's great. That's awesome. I know Rick Kelly's got all his stuff all boxed up and all labeled, you know, for every year that he's driven. And that's cool. But it just wasn't really my thing, I suppose, so much. And so I did sell off a lot of memorabilia and bits and pieces, and so it means that it's now spread amongst fans and collectors and people who appreciate that stuff, and they've got one or two items. I haven't got 150 items sitting somewhere in a box. People have got that, and they appreciate it, and that's awesome. And I'm pretty happy that's the way it turned out. As far as what I've still got, that is. Reference to, you know, my career. I've still got a bunch of helmets, not as many as I probably now. If I could go back in time, something I would keep is probably helmets, to be honest. And I know there's a lot floating around out there. And again, that's cool. So I've got a few helmets that I've kept. Trophies, the main trophies that I've got are Bathurst trophies. You know, they take pride of place. One thing that I did get replicas of, because race teams, you know, pay the bills, so they get to keep most of the trophies or the originals. One thing I did do was get replicas made of all the surfboards that I won at the Gold Coast, because I just thought that they were just a real colourful, really cool piece to have hanging on walls. So I've got those in a shed. But other than that, that's pretty much it. Heaps of photographs, heaps of that kind of stuff. A lot of the stuff that I really do like is the work that people have done, the drawings of race cars. Not so much the photos, but, you know, illustrations of race cars and stuff. So I've got a bit of that stuff lying around the place. But, you know, I did empty it out a few years ago and got rid of a lot of things.
I remember that there was a Kiwi artist, Don Packwood, who did a beautiful painting of your
lavender.
Hammer code, and you've got the original, and there were prints done there. It's a beautiful piece.
It is.
It's a nice little segue in, but is that the car that if, and I know big expense to own an old race car, storage, keeping it running, all that sort of stuff, but if all of that stuff wasn't a factor, is that the car that you would, one car from your career that you'd like to keep or have under your turnkey?
Yeah, absolutely. Not too much shock and horror in me saying that. Yeah, it is. And the rebuild and the of that car was done, you know, at our workshop in where were we? Dandenong there, when Tasman was operating. So John Anderson bought the the car and then had it converted back to basically as it was in 2003, even with its the shock towers still in place. Even though it had been converted to a double A-arm car, it still had the shock towers because it was a bit of a hybrid at the time. And George Smith from Dencar, who was the bloke, one of the blokes, along with Dennis, who did all the work back in the day, went in and rebuilt that car back to its former glory. So, you know, a great piece of history and obviously special to me and special to a lot of people. But, you know, that car is currently, you know, I think still up for sale. I think it's at Bathurst Museum at the moment. And I was really lucky once it did get finished to actually do a couple of laps at Bathurst in the 50th anniversary event. And I tell you, mate, stepping back in and climbing back in that car, H pattern, the simplicity of it all, and driving around that racetrack, oh, my God. I mean, I would love out of any race car at all to spend some more time aboard that vehicle, and because it was an amazing period of my career, and it does hold some special memories, of course.
Special memories for so many people that I don't think, no matter what speeds are achieved in the future, whether they're seconds faster, which they are now, the momentum of that day will never be changed. So it's one that we get. I mean, you know, we cover the history of the cars as a big part of what we do, and it's one of the most asked about cars that we get from any of the fans out there. And I think that's going to be the case for a very, very long time to come. One car or two cars that aren't.
I've got a model of it. I've got a model.
Well, that's a start. It's
And they're worth more than what they should be too.
They are. They've gone up in value since they came out back in 2003. That's for sure. By the way, we do a model car podcast, the Motor Focus model car podcast. So we might have to talk about Murph cars on the secondhand market for an upcoming episode of all the cars you should have bought but you didn't buy that are now worth 10 times what they were when you...
That's right.
Hey, did you keep your trophies from your Bathurst class wins, the Vectra and the Astra? Do you remember winning?
The class, Astra. did we get given trophies?
I don't know. Someone probably swiped them.
Yeah, I think they'll be on a mantle somewhere they'll be in a box somewhere, probably floating around Rob Crawford's place or something. I don't know. They'll be, yeah, who knows? Shit. I don't think I oversaw them. Funny, how funny. I forgot about that.
I think we slipped a couple of those photos into our new Holden book, Racing the Lion, Illustrated History of Holden in Motorsport, which you do feature quite a bit in across the journey, and there's a little bit of Vectra and Astra action there for the small car production car.
How about my teammate? How about my larger-than-life teammate at the time?
Which one?
Sam.
Oh, Sammy Newman. That's right. Yeah. So it was one year you and Rich. This was the GTP3 hour on the Saturday afternoon. So
GTP3 hour. Sounds so good.
In a Vectra.
Yeah.
Which I reckon was probably flat out breaking 3 minutes around the mountain, would it not be?
Oh,
on a good day.
I think it might have only just, yeah.
We'll get back to the podcast in just a moment, but I wanted to quickly tell you about our good friends at Timken, a world leader in engineered bearings and mechanical power transmission products and services. Now, you might know their name and you might recognise their logo, but did you know that Timken bearings are used in the centrepiece of one of the most stunning stadiums in the world of sport? The $2 billion, yes, billion-dollar Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta features a retractable roof that is a work of incredible engineering. It features 8 triangular roof panels, or pedals as the designers call them, that slide open and close in the same way that a camera shutter does. Each pedal weighs almost 500 metric tons, and when the roof is closed, each pedal cantilevers over 60 metres from the outer edge of the stadium. Now, despite the weight, the size and the complexity of the design, the roof can be closed in just over 7 minutes and open in just over 8, with Timken's tapered roller bearings used to ensure each pedal moves smoothly. The stadium's home to the Atlanta Falcons NFL team and the Atlanta United Major League Soccer team, and in 2019, it hosted the crown jewel of American football, the Super Bowl. We'll bring you more cool facts about Timken in each episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast through the course of the year. Now, it's back to the podcast.
Hey, there's heaps to chat about. We'll keep zipping through it. It's probably an excuse to do another one somewhere down the track because there's plenty of things I've skipped across. What I don't want to skip across, though, are our National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions, where the fans have sent in a few questions. I'll bounce through them quickly. I talked about 05. There's a lot. In fact, more questions about Bathurst 05 than any other topic when we threw it out there a week or so ago. So, three parts. Be nice. Part A, what did you and Ambrose actually say to one another? Can you give us the full version and we'll bleep anything that is too fruity that needs to be bleeped?
Oh, God. A lot of finger pointing. And it was along the lines of, you know, go f*** yourself, why don't you just f*** off over to America, I'll f*** buy your f***ing ticket, I don't know.
The bleep machine just blew up.
Yeah. It was wild, absolutely wild, far out. There's, I tell you right now, if I knew what was going to happen, I would have actually, not been as pig-headed to try and hold my line through that corner and that he bailed out of that one and let him have it.
Right. Okay. So this is the cooler, mellower, mature Murph saying, in hindsight, you would have done.
Well, the thing is, you know, we went in as much as
you were cooked, weren't you? You had to pit again, didn't you?
Oh, no, don't think so. No, I don't think so, but we were out of it. I mean, we were fourth and fifth, and we weren't going to win. Neither of us, I doubt we're going to get the podium. The guys ahead of us, where everyone was trucking along pretty good, it was pretty late. Was it lap 147 or something?
Yeah, around that, 15 or so to go. Yeah.
I don't remember that we were going to have to pit again.
I had a weird feeling that your car, that because by that stage you'd swapped to the Perkins engines, and I think you were out of whack on the – strategy. I might be wrong. My memory.
Maybe. I honestly don't recall. It might have been the case, but it was a bit of a struggle of a day, and you know, I didn't feel from what I remember. I was pretty comfortable. Marcus, I don't think had anything special as speed goes on me, but I got balked heavily by, I think, David Besnard going into turn two and Griffiths, and I sort of. He sort of turned down on me when I was trying to pass him and lost all my momentum and that allowed Marcus to come up alongside on the run up to turn three. And it was just one of those pig-headed moments where, you know, he wasn't going to give in and I didn't give in. And he had his nose ahead, but there was no pass completed. And so, you know, I've always been quite open. The fact that I believe we both contributed to it, and I always was happy to take 50% of the blame for it because it was a goddamn mess. You know, it's one of those things, and we'll agree to disagree, I'm sure, but, you know, it was just a shit sandwich that sort of wished never had happened, obviously. Mm. And if he had my time again and I could bloody go and repeat it, you know, knowing what has happened, you probably would bail out of it.
When you say what has happened, do you mean...
Oh, just afterwards.
The fact that the cars were out of the race and you were out, or the fact that it's going on for 10 years and we're still talking about it?
Yeah, all that, and the fact we're still talking about it, because it was not like it was a great moment in my life, in my career, and not for him either. You know, and it soured, obviously, you know, just added to fuel to probably a bit of the fire that was already burning maybe between us anyway, I suppose. And I mean, I got a huge amount of respect for the guy. I mean, I think his ability behind the wheel of a racing car was proven and you know, won two championships and went off to America and did, as far as I'm concerned, did great things over there, you know, achieved a lot. So, you know, kudos to him for that. You know, it was just, it was messy up there that day and, as I say, there was already a bit of a festering scab between the two of us, I suppose, and that just you know, made it a whole lot worse. And the other thing is, a lot of other people got caught up in that. You know, that didn't deserve to be caught up in our shit or my shit or his shit or whatever. That you know, blocked the track and damage was done to other cars, all that kind of thing. And I I don't want that to happen. Didn't want that to happen. And it was almost a little embarrassing.
We get asked really regularly. There's a common belief among a lot of people that your car was actually drivable. Can you once and for all categorically tell the fans who believe otherwise why your car was out of the race?
Yeah, listen, it smacked the wall pretty hard. It had done damage to the front, and I think it broke the Watts link or something in the back. But to be honest, I don't know. It might have been able to be driven back. It was the whack on the wall and the amount of the impact that sort of got me. It was like, oh well, she's done. She's buggered. And instead of probably trying to drive it, I didn't. And subsequently, the likes of probably Steve Henderson or someone, you know, who was my engineer, and the boys back then probably confirm or deny if that was the case. But I think if I didn't try to drive it back because I thought with the whack, there's no way she's going to be mobile. And so that's why I did stop. I didn't stop to bloody get out and go and have a fight with him. I stopped because I thought my car was buggered. So if it could have or not, that would be for someone else to confirm who was part of the race team.
We will follow up with that because we will keep getting asked by the fans about that. Anyway, we'll keep
zooming. Yeah, and the car looks okay, you know?
Yeah.
You know, up against the fence. So, if it could have been driven back, I can't remember the boys at the time confirming that it could have or not. I'm not sure.
It was out of the race in terms of winning or finishing on the podium. So if you ain't first, you're last at that place.
We certainly weren't going to bloody go down a couple of gears and carry on like nothing had happened, that's for sure.
No.
It's a given.
Saren's got the next question. True or false? There were some rumours. Is it true or false that you were close to setting up a HSV New Zealand V8 team in the 2000s?
No.
There you go. Easy one. I like to give easy questions every now and then. Matthew asks, why didn't your year at Paul Morris Motorsport work out? 888 cars, cool Castrol livery. What's your end take on why that didn't work out to be as good as it probably could have been, should have been, or was hoped to be?
Yeah, certainly on paper that was that looked like it should have been pretty good. Not really quite sure. It was an interesting start to the year. I missed the first round, which was a weird way to start. I didn't know I was going to have a drive in 2010. I went off and made a few other plans in the meantime, and then thanks to Russell had a part to play, but also Deirdre at Castrol and a bunch of other people who you know. Allowed me to have that gig that year, so you know they would have thanked for it. But mate, it was a weird one because we had these cars, and I assumed you know it was going to be good. They were what was the go there? They were built under license, I think, at Paul Morris's, weren't they? The chassis or something, I think, weren't they?
Yeah, it was 888 design, 888 IP, but physically
all their gear.
They're at PMM.
But I don't know. I think both Russell and I struggled to get on top of that and what was required, and it's some good people there at PMM, and but it was a real struggle. I know it was a real frustrating, not only just for us, but it was also for Paul, but we did some testing at Queensland Raceway. I know I think Jamie drove my car at one stage and showed that there was a little bit of time in a couple of places, but we just could never make it really work. The highlight, I think, was Tasmania, wasn't it? Mm. Finished on the podium, I think, at Tassie on the Sunday. Other than that, it was pretty lackluster. And then basically by the end of the year, it had all sort of, for me, it had gone very averagely, and it wasn't working out. And I can't even remember, it was 10 years ago, exactly what caused it all to fall and for me to disappear. I think Castro also hadn't committed, maybe moving forward as well. I think everyone just decided to go their separate ways. But it was tough. It was really hard.
because that was the Castrol car, I'm going to give that our Castrol question of the week because it's something that nobody else asked in terms of the questions in the podcast. So, Matthew, thanks for the
question. No one else remembers it. It wasn't memorable. It was the coolest livery. I loved the look of that car. I just thought it was the mega, mega looking livery. And then, you know, as you know, I've had a long, strong relationship with the Castrol and still do, and it's always an enjoyable bunch of people to do things with.
Yeah, and that's our Castrol question of the week, Murph, because remember, you know this, Castrol is more than just oil. It's liquid engineering, isn't it? They provide the oils, fluids and lubricants for today and the future for every driver, every rider and every industry. And you can follow Castrol on Facebook to stay across the latest in motorsport, exclusive comps and much, much more, including some pretty cool retro content. And I've got a funny feeling there might be a picture or two of that Castrol Edge 2010 car rolling through that account in the next few weeks. Liz asks, any chance you would have a run in Touring Car Masters?
I've been asked that a bit actually, and there's been the odd sort of suggestion about it, but you know, the commitment that requires for that as well is huge. I mean, the guys that are in that all the time are seriously committed and put a lot of effort into it. And you know, living in New Zealand, it just doesn't really work. And then at the moment, also at the race meetings, I'm usually working, doing other things. There's a lot of clash going on there. And you know, it's not something that I ever really had on my plan to do, was to go down that path. And everyone's a little bit different. Some guys just love racing week in, week out and doing that kind of thing. I was always after different things. And that's why I did a bit of rallying, because it was just something on my bucket list that I wanted to do. And whereas, you know, the Touring Car Master thing, the cars are awesome. They're so cool, but just not something that I ever had on my radar to follow through with.
Yep. No, fair enough. Rev Danger, good Instagram handle, that one. What road safety programs are you involved in, and what would you recommend a Wellington boy do to upskill his driving? So,
serious question.
Yeah, serious question. We have some occasionally, but it's obviously it's an area that's of great concern to us all. But of course, for those in motorsport who can use their influence to pass on knowledge and info and experience, what are you involved in that side of things over there in NZ? And a little bit of advice, I guess, for someone who's young, developing their driving skills on the road.
Yeah, so I'm heavily involved in road safety sort of stuff over here, and I've been involved with a program that actually Holden was involved in a couple of years ago, getting off the ground. It's called Street Smart. So it was called Holden Street Smart. It's not anymore, but Street Smart is still continuing. And it's a practical awareness program, basically. So you turn up at a facility, usually one of the race circuits around New Zealand, because it's the only place that we can have a whole lot of asphalt to use in a controlled environment. And we do a 10-stage program during a day, and eight of those are involved in driving cars and learning a little bit about emergency braking, awareness of peripheral vision. We simulate nose-to-tail incidents. We simulate head-on incidents, all that kind of stuff. And it's a program that has been designed by one of New Zealand's leading, if not most renowned road safety researchers and scientists, and it's something that I'm pretty proud of to be involved in. So that program, the Street Smart program, you can get on www.streetsmart.nz, and there is the ability to actually log your name and your interest in doing a day. Unfortunately, we can't run them in Wellington because there's no venue there that we can do it, but we do and are looking to continue an involvement with Manfield up in the Manawatu and do days there as well. So get online and have a look at that. And unfortunately at the moment, we are struggling a bit with trying to get the funding together to do as many days as we would like to be doing for Street Smart, because as far it is a user pays, but unfortunately the money that is paid by the user is only about a quarter of what we need to run a day. So we're working through that at the moment to try and find partners. But road safety is really important to me. Way too many lives are being damaged or lost through just unnecessarily because of the lack of training that we give young people or anybody driving a motor vehicle.
Great stuff. That's great. So just a reminder, that website, so .nz, you reckon it might be? For,
yeah, I think it is. You know, actually, while I'm here, I'll have a quick look, but I'm pretty sure it's streetsmart.nz.
A little
bit. So yeah, that's something I'm involved in, but yeah, it's important that we continue to try to help young people out there.
Mm. No, absolutely. How's Google going?
Yeah, it is. streetsmart.nz.
There you go. You were right the first time. You should have backed yourself.
It's not .co. There's no co because you'll end up in a property.
Not the place to end up. No. A couple more. Ken Wills asks, I can't wait to listen to this episode. Can you ask Murph what was it like driving with Scaife in 09 and was that the Bathurst win that got away?
Great to drive with Scaife. I mean, because obviously he is an icon of our sport. We've had battles and battles and battles over the years, you know. I think there was a fair intense rivalry there, especially when we came to Pukekohe. Couldn't think of anyone better to beat at Pukekohe than Mark Scaife. I know how much it rolled him up, so that was pretty cool. But to end up sharing a car together was bloody awesome. And it did get away from us, for sure. But it's one of those races where the safety car, just like it has done many, many times before, probably gave us a chance to be back in the race. And then it cruelly also took it away from us later in the race. So that is, and everyone's got stories, right? So I'm not going to say that, you know, that race was ours and it should have been ours or anything like that. But the facts are the facts. And we had positioned ourselves thanks to obviously a few things falling into our lap during the day. After they'd also been taken away, you know, it put us in a position to be, at the front of the field. We were following Greg Ritter at the time, who was also on the same strategy as us, who also got screwed by that same safety car, but we had more fuel in our car than what he did. So our stop was always shorter. We had the pace of him, but our stop was going to be shorter and was going to bring us out in front with only a stint to go. And the speed that the car was in the dry, you know, I don't believe we would have got beaten. But it's the same story. And every driver, well, that I know, has probably got one where they can say a similar thing could have happened. So it is just what it is. But for a race that I didn't win, it was also one of the most rewarding. So to come from 13th with only a handful of laps remaining, or however many laps it was in that last stint, 13th, to come through and only be pipped by Lee Holdsworth by 0.0 something of a second at the finish line was actually one of the most enjoyable drives I've ever had.
I thought you might say that. So I got this ready. In fact, actually, Will Dale, who produces our podcasts and co-hosts some of these episodes with me, did. You did get a record that day, but it's not a record you want. You've got a lot of great records, but you hold a record for the closest miss of a podium in Bathurst 1000 history because the margin was 0.0042.
Was it really?
That's all it was. There's a photo we've got here and the checkered flag's waving, the Valvoline car's just about at the finish line, and I reckon if you measured it in an actual measurement, I'm sure you can figure it out from the mathematics, but it's in centimetres. It is almost too hard to pick the cars.
If I didn't like Lee Holdsworth so much, if it was someone else, I probably would have punted them, to be honest. But he's such a good bloke. There was no way I could do that.
So. You're too kind. You're too kind. You were mellowing in your older years. Another one here from a young lady on the Gold Coast. I think her name's Rihanna. Does he miss me or Larko more?
Shit, that's a hard. That's actually probably the toughest question I've been given tonight, to be honest.
Oh, which one?
It's incredible, eh? When you don't have it, how much you do miss the people that you spend so much time with, assuming on those weekends. And you know, we've generated a pretty cool team there with Ree and Larko and Elaine there, and obviously AJ as well, and just everybody. All the people I work with and that are speaking in your ear, you know, Emma and DT and Ange and Nathan and everybody else. It's just an amazing family. And right now it is very weird not being a part of it. So, yeah, it's you get so used to it. And I can't believe it's 6 years of being in that role. Although this year, I don't know if I can count as a full year, but it's amazing how quick it goes and the things that have happened.
So which one do you miss more?
Oh, Ree.
All right. There we go.
Hi, Lauren.
Hey, he got to name your dog, so he's already had a win. Chris Pegg asks, he took you around Albert Park and Phillip Island on parade laps in an orange Corvette some years ago. And he said, apart from a bit of insight on the braking markers and lines, but you mentioned that you had a charger that you were restoring in NZ. And I remember that you talked about this with Rusty. So that's a fair while ago now, though. How's the charger going? Is it finished? Where are you at with it? What's going on?
It is not far off being finished. It's in America. It's at a company called Ring Brothers, who are one of America's top car builders, focusing on muscle cars, and amongst a few other things. But I went to SEMA in Vegas, 2014, I think it was, and saw a car that they launched at SEMA that year. It was called Recoil, which was a 66 Chevelle. And I fell in love with that car and I was like, wow, that's amazing. And from that day on, they were on my radar as far as builders of cool cars. But it was only a couple of years ago that I actually contacted them and said, listen, no, I've got this car, you know, thinking that they would just like laugh at me and say, we're too busy. We've got better things to do. But they didn't. They said, we'd love your car. We'd love to see it over there. Not knowing anything about me or who I was. They just, that's what we do. And so subsequently, the car got sent to America. And it's been there since December 2018, I think it was. And it's nearly finished. It'll be finished probably by early next year, just working around their schedule at the moment, where they've got a few projects, which has just pushed mine to the side a little bit. But it's painted and it's on its feet, and it needs interior and it needs a few other bits and pieces, but it is looking very good. And if anyone asks me for a photo, no, you're not going to get one.
Okay, I'll scratch that follow-up question then. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a follow-up question. What else have you got, just quickly, cars-wise? Have you got any other little projects on the go?
No more projects. The Charger is definitely the finale as far as projects go, because it is a pretty serious one and one that is, been difficult for my good wife to understand, which is fair enough. But I don't know, I've had to think about 69 Chargers since I was a kid watching Dukes of Hazzard. And this one has been, I've owned it now since 2007, this car. So it [S2] Right. [S1] Is a long, long, long time. But it is going to be, it's going to be everything that I ever wanted it to be. So that'll be pretty cool. Other projects, no, but I've got my Datsun 1200 SSS, which is pride and joy. I had one when I was a kid and I wrote that off when I was 19, which I regretted every day since. And that's also one of the reasons why I'm involved in road safety, because I was very lucky back in the day to get away with riding a car off and not being hurt or injured or killed. And it woke me up big time back in the day to realize, that it can happen to anybody at any time, these things. And so I've got one of those, which and also you may have seen during lockdown doing the odd video, which surprised a lot of people. I have a Mark II Ford Escort 1600 Sport in the garage, which just recently got finished as well. So that's pretty cool to have there. A couple of old classics, very special cars. I've got a bloody rally car if anyone wants to buy one. Got a very good, only driven kindly and slowly on Sundays, Barina AP4 rally car. That's for sale. Almost at a point where I'm taking offers on that because it needs to go. So, yes.
Anyone who's interested, pass on a note. We'll pass it on to Greg.
That's right.
David Tomek's got our last of our National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions. He says he's got Murph's Law, which was the book that came out in 2004. He's got Murph, which I think came out in about 2015, 16, somewhere around there. Right. He said, can we expect a 2.0 autobiography of your later career stuff, post-supercars, media, rallying, other stuff?
No, not interesting. No one would buy it. Struggled to sell the last two books.
come on now, come on now. I've got a few ideas.
There's nowhere near as much controversy now. So, you know, who's interested
true.
In that?
That's yeah. true. We're going to have to wait for some people to DNF before you can tell some real stories about them. So, hard to tell them that they're still here and that they can still sue you. But I've got a couple of ideas in that regard, so I might share them with you when we're offline. Just quickly before we wrap up, we do the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. You topped one of the greatest shootouts at Bathurst in 03 with that Lap of the Gods, but we have the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. And Motor Focus is in Australia, the home of quality scale models. They stock them all, the big brands, plenty of your cars over the years. They're online, motorfocus.com.au, or you can pop in and see them at Unit 9, number one Stockwell Place in Archerfield, Queensland. They are going to be at the Townsville V8 round coming up.
Oh, yeah. I've been to their tent plenty of times.
Yeah, back-to-back weekends. Dimitri and the team will look everyone up. As this podcast airs, it's the second Townsville event that's coming up this weekend. So basically,
I just turn on the light.
Oh, mate, right. There you go.
I just turn on the light. Look, all of a sudden, it look worse or better. Better or worse.
Can you turn the light back off?
There's
a call.
Turn the light back off. No. I don't. No. It's all right.
That was a joke. By the way, for those who are listening to the podcast, we are on a Zoom call. We have been changing our backgrounds constantly throughout this whole podcast as well. I've stuck with the Oryx Audi A4 and Murph stuck with the Kmart Castrol VY Commodore. This is word association. You tell me the first word or two that come into your head when I say the following things, okay? Oh, you're shaking your head and you got your hand in your...
I hate these things.
All right. Just reflex action. First thing that comes to mind, Avan's Throne.
Say that again?
Avan's Throne.
Avan Muller.
You know, the toilet, the 5-minute stop, it had a label on it. It was called Avan's Throne.
Oh, Gerald McDornan, one of his finest moments.
There's two words, Gerald and McDornan, the PR guy for Kmart. That was his doing. What's the word that springs to mind when I say Super Tourers?
Audi.
Fair point. Just because it's on my backdrop of my video at the moment.
Pretty much.
Reynard 92D.
Oh, joy.
Oh, nice. Short words too. This is going well. Yeah. You gave a character assessment of this guy a little earlier, but you can have another crack at him here. Rick Kelly.
Mad.
I think his son's...
And more words. Great mate. Great friend.
Actually, quickly, his kid looks like he's taken over everybody's role in the pit lane in the last week or two with some of his work.
I'm going to be out of a job for sure.
He's been lightning, little Lex. One thing that occurred to me too, I ask everyone who's won a Bathurst what it changed in their life, but just quickly, what's the bond between drivers who... You go your separate ways after winning Bathurst to other teams. Some guys leave the sport, retire. Rick's still going. Relationships can change. It's like friendships from school, I guess. But that bond forever that you are Bathurst winners together, talk to me about how special that is and the special bond you have with Rick and also with Richo, because you won two each with those guys, and obviously two with Rick, one with Steve and one with Lounsey.
Yeah, I think... You obviously still mates with all those guys, but the bonds are really different. And I don't know what it was about Rick. I think obviously Lounsey and I and myself and Richo all similar sort of ages, really, and not too dissimilar to each other. Whereas Rick was a little bit different. You know, he's a bit younger, and I probably felt like a bit of a mentor to him a little bit at the time too. And we had this really seamless, easy sort of gel between us, and you know, we've always had it, and we've always been quite close in that respect, and I think just had a lot of mutual respect for each other, and we've just had a lot of laughs, a lot of fun, and you know, over the years. And so I think, you know, I don't know what his thoughts are. We've never really said anything about it. We probably wouldn't, but I mean, asking him about it would be interesting to get a response, I suppose, on what he sees about it. But yeah, it's something we've sort of continued on ever since in respect of, our friendship and we've been joined, I suppose, because, as you say, because of those milestones in our careers together, and the fact he hasn't won another one since, you know, I don't think he's ever going to now, obviously, because he's not going to be able to have me as a co-driver.
I was wondering how you're going to finish that sentence there, and probably I should have predicted that that was going to deliver. Next part of the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout, I warmed you up with your Bathurst co-drivers. The word to describe Steve Richards?
Reliable.
Mm-hmm. Yep, his record would back that up for sure. Pukekohe.
Cathedral.
Oh, that's good. I like that. I like that. Mark Scaife.
Annoying.
Got a funny feeling.
For all the positive reasons though, right? Because he's just relentless. Let's say relentless.
That's a good word.
Yeah, because he just never stops.
Garth Tander.
He's annoying.
You can't use the same thing twice. That's the rule.
No, because Scaife's relentless. Tander's annoying because he's usually comes up with the smart ass comments on any Instagram post that I put up. But he's also what would we say? He's fast.
Mm, still is. Two to go. Jim Richards.
Icon.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that. AIR punt victim is probably the word.
That's right. That's exactly right. One of you remembers that. One of you's still, he's always held that as a grudge. I wonder.
We'll check and report back to you down the track. Last one, Greg Rust.
There's so many words to describe Greg Rust, so many words, but he's like a soulmate, he's not mine necessarily, but he would be to lots of people. But I mean, what's another word to describe that? He's just one of those. He's such a decent human. That's two words though.
That's okay. You're allowed to have two. But I thought that, I know he's your neighbour and all, but soulmate was, I thought, wow.
Yeah, no, well, I needed another word to describe it sort of from everyone's perspective. But
I get what you mean. Yeah. I get what you mean. Yeah. I get what you mean. Hey, mate, it's been a pleasure. I know we've taken up probably more of your time than you had to give. Again. Yes,
a lot more.
Sorry.
Mate, I am busy over here in lockdown. I've got so much going on.
Well, I can help you with that. I'll send you a copy of our Racing the Line Holden Illustrated book. It's out now from our online bookshop, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. I'll jam one in the post. It'll get there in 2023, by which time we've probably done another 17 books. But
I might have to canoe over covertly onto the beaches in Port Melbourne and just meet you there to grab it and then canoe back out again.
Bring your waterproof backpack and we'll load a couple in there for the trip back. Right. Mate, a pleasure. Plenty of stuff that we didn't get to today. I hope we didn't hurt the brain cells too much. We're trying to remember some stuff from back in the old days. But so much for us to chat about again. We'll do it again another time when we're all locked down and can't do anything exciting. In the meantime, though, stay well and good to chat. Great stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Sleuth.
There you have it, Greg Murphy on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Timken. It was fantastic to sit down with Murph and talk about a bunch of stuff that he probably hasn't thought about for quite a few years. He gave us a whole heap of his time. So a big thanks to Murph for sitting down with me and going down memory lane. A reminder too, our V8 Sleuth online bookshop is open for business. And of course, our new Racing the Lion Holden Motorsport Illustrated History book is a prominent part of that. It is available to order now if you go to bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Funnily enough, Greg Murphy does feature in our Bathurst Going Global 12-hour Bathurst book covering the last 10 years of GT racing in the 12-hour. He did it once in a Corvette. Bet you forgot about that one. So he's in that book as well. Of course, buy both books and postage is cheaper than it is if you buy the books separately. Great idea. Go to bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Thanks again too for all of your podcast feedback. Thanks for the questions and the thoughts. Tell your mates all about it. Subscribe. Send us a note through our V8 Sleuth website. We'd love to hear from you with any suggestions you've got for future episodes or people you might like us to sit down and have a chat to. We always love to hear from you. Of course, follow us in all the places as usual on social, in Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And subscribe to our newsletter too through our website, v8sleuth.com.au. You'll get the latest and greatest of offers and products and news on the website as well. Anyway, that's Greg Murphy done on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Thanks for listening. And we'll join you again for another episode very soon of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Timken.
Every lap in under a minute. Every move made to matter. Every decision impacting the outcome of the race. Supercars in Perth. Every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars. Unforgettable.